the anniversary of the day Israel was created and landed in Palestine, taking away land from Palestinians and expelling hundreds of thousands of Palestinians from their land. In this edition of the program, we will look at the significance of Nakba Day this year, why it is happening at a special time, and whether Israel, labeled an apartheid regime, is fast moving in not being recognized in the international arena due to its continuous violations. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of the Spotlight. Director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, Zafar Bangash, joins us from Toronto. We also have human rights activist and member of Manchester Palestine Action, Aidy Mormick, who joins us from Manchester.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome you both, and if I may first start with you, Zafar Bangash, taking a look at what this day Nakba is. Can you give us a quick background check, or should I say history check, as to why it's called Nakba and what your thoughts are on that in terms of a historical perspective?
Well, Nakba means catastrophe, and this is an expression that the Palestinians have given to what happened to them in May of 1948, when Zionist marauding gangs attacked more than 400 Palestinian villages and towns in Palestine, and not only ethnically cleansed hundreds of thousands of Palestinians, something like 750,000 to a million Palestinians, but also murdered a number of them. We are all familiar with Deir Yassin, where these war criminals like Ariel Sharon, Yitzhak Rabin, Yitzhak Shamir, Menachem Begin, these war criminals were all involved in perpetrating horrible crimes against the Palestinian people. And literally, of course, those 750 to a million Palestinians that were expelled, they have now, of course, now increased to something like 5-6 million, many of them in Jordan, in Lebanon, in Syria, and other countries around the world. But the important point is that the Palestinians have not forgotten their tragedy, and every year they commemorate Nakba Day to make sure that their future generations continue to remember that their land has been stolen from them, that alien invaders from Europe and North America invaded their land and have illegally settled on that land, and they unfortunately continue to do so even today. But the circumstances are changing, because we see that the manner in which the Zionists continue their brutality, the Palestinians have not given up. They have not become cowed down. So the important point to keep in mind is that while the Palestinians commemorate their Nakba Day, the Zionists have already lost the battle, because the one factor that they wanted to impose on the Palestinians, that is to terrorize them, to instill fear in them, the Palestinians have not been terrorized. They have not been submitted out of fear. And so the fact that they are willing to resist their occupiers already means that the Palestinians have won. And I believe that the day is not far away when this Zionist alien entity would be removed from occupied Palestine.
Okay, Aidy Mormick, you as an human rights activist and also a member, as I'm reading here, of Manchester Palestine Action, you have a direct account and experience with what Palestinians have gone through in terms of their suffering. And perhaps you can tell us about that, in particular, your experiences in the Gaza Strip, and then tell us your perspective as to the way the Palestinians have suffered. Okay, we're having some connection problems with you. Let me go to you, Zafar Bangash. So when you take a look at this particular Nakba, of which you said that Israel is losing legitimacy, perhaps at least based on recent memory, there haven't been so many incidents that have happened consecutively in a row that have catapulted the plight of Palestinians across the minds of people around the world. Because we had the month of Ramadan, we had what happened with the violation at the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and then in turn the heavy-handed tactics that Israelis used against the Palestinians. You had the couple instances where you had Palestinians that came out and showed their anger. Unfortunately, some lives, Israeli lives, were lost. And then you had what happened with this reporter who was assassinated in the form and manner that she did. And also you had the Al-Quds rallies. 2 years with the COVID lockdown, people had a chance finally to come out and show their support for Palestinians. All of these put together, do you think that there's a new momentum that is now present, that maybe it's time for this to be taken to another level?
Oh, absolutely. What you have outlined is exactly the situation as we find today. And in fact, the fact that the Palestinians have not given up hope, the fact that they have not given up their struggle, and you mentioned that Shirin Abu Akleh was martyred, assassinated, outside Jenin refugee camp. Now, Jenin is a hotbed of resistance in Palestine. In fact, there are a number of other areas as well, but Jenin in particular, and it has a very long history. In fact, it was the 20th anniversary of their uprising when 20 years ago, the Zionists perpetrated brutal massacres in Jenin, and yet the people of Jenin have not surrendered. They have not been cowed down. I also want to point out the fact that over the last few months, there have been a number of reports published by international human rights organizations that includes Amnesty International, that includes Human Rights Watch, that includes even the UN Human Rights Council that have published reports. And in fact, only last month, Professor Michael Link, who was the special rapporteur for Palestine, UN rapporteur for Palestine, who's a Canadian professor, they published reports, all of them, including, incidentally, B'Tselem, which is an Israeli human rights organization. They have all pointed out that Israel is an apartheid regime. And this thing itself, this designation itself, is now gaining ground worldwide. And we also see that the fact that the Palestinians are standing up, rising up, they're not giving up their rights, they are determined to resist their occupiers, clearly indicates that there is now a new level of resistance that has emerged among the Palestinians. And so the Zionists themselves are terrified. A few days ago, the former Israeli prime minister, and he also used to be the Israeli army chief, Ehud Barak, actually issued a statement. It is incredible that he said that I'm not so sure that Israel would be able to celebrate its 80th anniversary of independence. Now, that's an incredible statement to make, coming from a figure as high up as a former prime minister and a former army chief, which indicates that there is a new reality,
sure,
a ground reality.
Hold on to that thought. Hold on to that thought, because I have the statement that he said, Zafar Bangash, and I'd like to elaborate on that statement with you since you brought it up. But since we have Adi Mormick back, Adi Mormick, welcome back. My question to you is the direct experience that you have had firsthand seeing the Palestinians and how they suffer. Perhaps you can elaborate on that for us and describe to us what you saw and what you experienced. And I'm talking in particular in the Gaza Strip.
Yeah, I mean, I was in Gaza for 2 years and I was a teacher in the university there, the Al-Aqsa University. Two of my students were killed. One of them, her entire family were killed. Her two little babies, her mother and her father-in-law and husband, all killed with one bomb. I taught a family that lost 29 members of their extended family in 3 days, the Samouni family, during the bombing of 2008-09. And I taught them a year later when they were still living in the chicken coop just by their house that had been obliterated, as had all their houses, as had so many of their family members. When you knock on a door in Gaza and you ask where they're from, they will tell you a place that doesn't exist anymore. They'll tell you Mejdel or Bejerja or Barbara or many of the villages that no longer exist because of the Nakba. They are continuously living in Gaza, which is the largest refugee camp in the world, 1.2 million people in one of the most crowded places on the planet. And they are surrounded by Israeli jets in the sky. If you go in Gaza, you have F-16s in the sky and drones regularly bombing and surveilling the country. You have the gunships on the horizon in the sea, which is actually destroying the fishing industry. The kids who go and look out to the horizon on the sea might have dreams and hopes, and yet they see Israeli gunships controlling the sea borders. And then on the land borders, if you go there, you see the snipers and the tanks and the jeeps lining along the frontier with Israel there in Gaza. And that is the land area where people are regularly shot merely for going to school or farming in the most arable land, which they can no longer do because of the level of atrocities that are inflicted at the border. Not to mention the regular bombings. And I was there during the bombing of Gaza, and we saw kids after children and many parents coming in to the intensive care unit, being rolled around with dust coming off them. And this is the sharp edge of Israeli brutality. And what's more, this is the ongoing Nakba, because these people are victims of the 1948 Nakba. Most of them are refugees, United Nations registered refugees. And you're seeing it now. This is not finished. The most recent announcement, the decision by the Israeli court that Masa Fuata, which is eight hamlets, communities just south of Nablus in the West Bank, that's going to be ethnically cleansed. The ethnic cleansing continues. So whereas Gaza has been made into this horrific medieval siege and a completely blockaded territory of a population that is mostly children, right now you're seeing across the rest of Palestine some utterly horrific shows of brutality. And what I would say is, for me in Gaza and for Palestinians and for those that have been well acquainted with the Palestinian issue, we are not surprised, sadly, by the level of brutality. We are not surprised. But instead, we are seeing so many people around the world shocked by what's seen on the funeral of Shireen Abu Akla. And when people are being pushed around and beaten with batoned, and you're getting Gary Lineker and Piers Morgan, famous people in England, sharing it. 11 million people seeing that brutality. For us, we've seen it again and again and again. You're seeing Palestinians right now being forced out of another house in Hebron. And yet, right now, people around the world are seeing full on the level of Israeli brutality that is inflicted on so many Palestinians. And that is the ongoing Nakba. But what I would say is, as the other gentleman said, people are waking up. There is no question. When you get famous people sharing it and 11 million seeing that horrific episode with the funeral of Shireen Abu Akla, you are seeing a massive change. And there is a youth movement in England. We're talking about what Israel said. They said that the young ones will forget, the old will die and the young ones will forget. Well, believe me, the youth in Manchester here, we have a big Nakba demonstration tomorrow. And it's the youth leading it. So they are not forgetting. They will carry on. And the world is changing right now. And they are changing every year. Just like May last year with the mass murder of 250 Palestinians, 67 kids in 10 days. This May, you have the Nakba again. And you have a journalist being killed in cold blood. And media is finally having to report it. People are waking up. And this is another sea change. Things are changing rapidly. You're seeing it with the Amnesty report. You're seeing it, as you say, with even Israeli ex-generals speaking out against what's happening. This is real. And finally, right, we might see an end to apartheid Israel, the system of horrific oppression against the Palestinians, just like we have seen the end of apartheid in South Africa. And I don't think it's that far away. The world is changing. People are waking up now.
Zafar Bangash, so you hear Aidy Mormick there, and I'm not too sure the energy that he that comes out of him, that exudes, that brings out what the truth, unfortunate truth, is. And it's very inspiring. Listen to what he is saying, and he's not that old. And so we're seeing this type of knowledge that has been transferred into action. In his case, to have gone into Gaza and to have taught there. And obviously, the word is being spread around. It's very promising, but at the same time, when you take a look at the track record, things are not moving in favor of Palestinians. So there needs to be a tidal wave to take over that. What can be done to build again on the momentum that I talked about a little bit earlier?
Well, first of all, I think I must compliment your other guest for his solidarity with the Palestinian people and spending 2 years in Gaza, which is, as you said, is an open-air prison. And this is to his great credit, and this shows his humanity and compassion in support of the legitimate rights of the Palestinian people. With respect to the struggle of the Palestinian people and the momentum, I think we need to understand that more and more people worldwide are now waking up to the reality of the absolute brutality of the Zionists. And people are no longer willing to buy into this Zionist propaganda that it's a besieged state, that it is a beleaguered state, etc. What is also important to keep in mind is that Zionist crimes are basically underwritten by the United States of America. And the United States itself is now going through into a tailspin. It is losing grip. It is losing wars. In fact, since the Second World War, the United States has not won a single war that it has been engaged in. Last year, it was driven out of Afghanistan. It's not got its way in many other parts of the world. So what we are beginning to see is, and now we also see that the U.S. is grappling with Russia. It's in fact waging a proxy war in Ukraine, but it's not getting its way. And there are countries that are rising up that are challenging U.S. Imperialist designs. And if the U.S. is brought to its knees, and I think that day is also not far because its mainstay is the U.S. dollar. And I think there are indications that when more than 50% of the countries of the world do not use the U.S. dollar, that would be the end of the U.S. itself. So if the U.S. economy collapses, which is an underwriter of the Zionist crimes, then obviously the Zionist regime would wither away. And of course, internally also, there are a lot of fissures in the Israeli society. You know, last year when the Zionists were bombarding the Gaza Strip for 11 days, and when the Israeli rulers asked to enter or send ground forces into Gaza, the military commanders refused. They said that we cannot do it because we cannot fight on multiple fronts. What they were referring to was that not only was it the people of Gaza, but people in the West Bank and also the Green Line, which is 1948 Palestine,
right.
The people were rising up and their military commander said that this situation we cannot control. And so now we see that within the Palestinian community, the Palestinians under occupation are in fact getting united, rising up, and they are confronting the Zionist bullets and guns and tanks with their bare hands and with stones. That, I think, is a very, very hopeful sign, and that definitely would lead to the elimination of this monstrous Zionist ideology and the liberation of Palestine.
Sure. I'd like to ask from you, Eddie Mormick, if I can test your memory here and go back to when you had the March of Return protests that were taking place, which wasn't too long ago. And basically, one of the things that stood out there was the way that Israel was targeting the protesters. And amongst them were journalists that were killed. Amongst them, there were, medics that were targeted. And, of course, you had children that were killed, and you had many who were wounded. Many people think that Israel was doing that in its self-defense. But perhaps you can open that up for us and paint the reality of what was going on there and what that meant. At least that's one of the things that stands out when it comes to the plight of Palestinians and the resistance.
At some point, there will be proper investigations into all of these deaths. When during the Great Return March, you remember Yasser Mataja, who was a journalist who I actually met quite a lot in Gaza, who was killed with his press top on then. That was 2018, the same time as also Razan al-Najjar, the medic, full medical clothing, who'd gone to attend some of those injured merely for protesting. When I was there in Gaza, we were marching free to march at the border areas where hundreds were there, and they were marching with their flags, marching towards the borders, and you had jeeps picking them off one by one. Ahmed Deeb, a 20-year-old, was killed right next to me, merely for marching. And I was saying to them, well, you're going to get shot if you get any closer. And he said, I'd rather die standing than die my bed, because that's the choice young 20-year-old guys have in Gaza. And in terms of investigations, well, guess what? Yasser Mataja and Razan al-Najjar, young people with futures who were skilled at their jobs, medics and journalists, were wiped out without trace, without investigation. Imagine if it was people who were in right now, Ukrainians who were getting bombed, and if they were being shot, medics and journalists, where would it be? It would be all over the news. It would be all over the world. We can't have double standards. Palestinians have the same rights as anybody else. Palestinian parents grieve the same as anybody else. They have been living this for 74 years. And so, just like the Goldstone report was about the family that I taught, the Samouni family, 29 members of their extended family murdered. And that was mostly children. And that was in 3 days, for goodness sake. And yet the Goldstone report said that these were probable war crimes, and nothing. There was no accountability. Finally, we are getting International Criminal Court changes. Finally, the United Nations is saying a little bit more. Even finally, some Western governments are starting to speak up a little bit, including, of course, the United Nations saying that some goods would be sanctioned as a big list. So it's all incremental. It will only lead to one place eventually, and that is that any apartheid regime, any regime that is purposefully and set out to oppress not only a large bunch of the local people, but the original indigenous population of Palestinians who have been there for thousands of years. And so finally, there will be comeuppance, just as there was for South Africa when there were massive investigations afterwards. And all of these crimes that we're seeing now will actually get some proper scrutiny and some proper investigation. Because right now, we're still miles off. Israel gets a green light. In fact, worse than that, Israel gets £38 billion over 10 years of aid from America, including mostly weapons grants. Britain is still dealing with Elbit Systems, which is the largest Israeli weapons company, developing their weapons by bombing Palestinians in Gaza and, you know, announcing it and selling those weapons as such. Fortunately, the world is changing. Fortunately, Palestinians still resist on the ground. In England, we have so many actions against the weapons factories now that have shut them down, including the one near here in Oldham. We've had HSBC divest from Elbit Systems because of the cluster bombs. We're going to have, I think, Puma soon will stop sponsoring the Israeli Football Association. And we've had loads of universities divest, like Manchester University from Caterpillar and other companies that are complicit. So there is ongoing changes internationally, and it will happen. And the people will hold Israel to account where governments and legal systems haven't. But eventually, just like South Africa, when the people acted like they are doing now in this growth, eventually the legal scrutiny will grow, and so will governments and institutions internationally, and that will hold Israel to account. It is a process. It is only going one way. Israel is out of control. They're not even caring anymore about what the world sees anymore. And finally, I think we will see freedom for Palestine in my lifetime, which is something I never thought I'd see. And eventually, apartheid, just like South Africa, will no longer be allowed to happen. And people all over that area will have the same rights as each other, which is hardly utopia. It's something that everybody should be expecting.
I was going to ask you about what you said, Zafar Bangash, and I think it's the right time, about the ex-premier Ehud Barak, who said Israel could cease to exist before the 80th anniversary, and what he said, that Jews have not ruled for more than 80 years on the trough throughout history, predicting a doom and gloom scenario once he said that. Where he said the present Israeli regime represents the third experience and is approaching the eighth decade of the entity's existence. Do you agree with him? If you could say that in 30 seconds.
I think all of the indications are, both internally as well as externally, that the Zionist ideology is heading for destruction. And this is because of their own arrogance, because the Palestinian people, in their absolute magnanimity, they have not said that they don't want to live with the Jewish people. In fact, they have not persecuted the Jewish people in their entire history. Whenever the Jewish people were persecuted elsewhere, they sought refuge either in Palestine or any other Muslim countries. And Muslims are proud of that fact and that history.
Okay.
But when you have this Zionist occupiers with this Zionist ideology of racism, of ethnic cleansing, coming into Palestine, and they want everything for themselves, then I think they are digging their own grave.
Very
and
well.
I believe that they are
Thank
heading
for that. Sorry, we're fresh out of time. Zafar Bangash there, Director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought. And it was great seeing you again. A.D. Mormick from Manchester. Hopefully tomorrow we can connect with you if you're going on the protest that you said you are for Nakba Day. Human rights activist and member of the Manchester Palestine Action. Thank you. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikael Vitapwe and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Dear listeners, hello everyone. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and in this edition, we will try to have a closer look at the 25th chapter, Surah Al-Furqan. First, let's just listen to the verses we're going to talk about in this program, and we'll be back shortly. So stay with us.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
وتوكل على الحي الذي لا يموت وسبح بحمده وكفى به بذنوب عباده خبيرا
And rely upon the ever-living who does not die and exalt Allah with his praise and sufficient is he to be with the sins of his servants acquainted.
Brothers and sisters, we were discussing the 58th verse of the chapter. وَتَوَكَّلْ عَلَى الْحَيِّ الَّذِي لَا يَمُوتْ وَسَبِّحْ بِحَمْدِهِ وَكَفَى بِهِ بِذُنُوبِ عِبَادِهِ خَبِيرًا This verse had mainly three parts. وَتَوَكَّلْ عَلَى الْحَيِّ الَّذِي لَا يَمُوتْ means rely on him ever living who dies not. وَسَبِّحْ بِحَمْدِهِ the second part and him his praise, celebrate with his praise. And the last part وَكَفَى بِهِ بِذُنُوبِ عِبَادِهِ خَبِيرًا And sufficient is he as being aware of the faults of the servants. Not the servants, better say his servants, as we said in the previous episode. Because even the sinners are considered as his servants. So there is no way that a servant should be disappointed when he commits a sin. Anyway, one of the most important concepts to be discussed regarding this verse is the concept of trust. In this verse, when the Holy Prophet ﷺ is ordered to forget all creatures and rely on the pure nature of Allah, he mentions some attributes for his pure nature, which are in fact the main qualifications of the one who can be the real and sure trust of the people. So, based on these rules, we can answer the question, whom must we trust? By paying attention to the attributes and qualifications of Almighty Allah mentioned in this verse, we can reach to the answer. The first attribute and qualification is that he must be alive, because a dead and unbeneficial creature, such as idols, cannot be someone's trust. The second qualification is that the one who we rely on must be immortal. The verse says, عَلَى الْحَيِّ الَّذِي لَا يَمُوتْ Why does he need to be immortal? So that those who trust him do not get worried and irresolute about his death. After all, this is what a hopeful man is staying hopeful for. The third qualification is that he must be omniscient. He must know both all the needs of those who trust in him and the plots and the plans of the foes and the enemies. وَكَفَى بِهِ بِذُنُوبِ عِبَادِهِ خَبِيرًا. He is aware of all the sins of his servants. And the fourth one is that he must be omnipotent, because he must have no weakness, he must have no disability that weakens this reliance. I mean, the reliance of the servant on the Almighty Allah must be accompanied with a kind of answer, which is the power of the Almighty Allah in controlling, in doing everything. And the fifth qualification is that the one who we can trust must manage and control all the affairs. We know that these attributes, all of them, are only found in the pure nature of Allah. And thus, He is the only one whom can be trusted and does not have instability in all events and disasters. So, these are the characteristics, qualifications, and the attributes of the one if we want to trust.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Now, because the concept of trust is so important, it is reflected on our traditions more than some other concepts. For example, about trust, the Holy Prophet ﷺ has said, "The one who wants to be the most pious person of people has to trust Allah." As we said earlier, trust on someone who is rightly deserving to be trusted is the tool to reach piety. And this is what the Holy Prophet is saying. Also, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam has said, "Fearing only Allah and not fearing other than Allah is reliance." This is the true meaning of trust. The best servants with Allah are those who trust Allah more and obey His commandments. This is what the Holy Prophet ﷺ is suggesting. Because what is the benefit of trusting someone without accepting his rules, orders, and commandments? It means if you want to check whether you are truly trusting on Allah or not, check and see for yourself whether you are obeying His commandments or you are disobeying Him. Let us have a look at one narration from Imam Ali alayhi salam as the last tradition in this episode. Imam Ali alayhi salam has said, "This is sufficient for your trust that you know no one as your sustainer is but Allah, the Glorious." Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. We ask
the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me, worry, and that's when faith begins.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. English Radio.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we're going to be looking at a question and examining a question that is kind of related to one of the surahs and chapters of the Holy Quran, and that is the last surah of the Holy Quran, which is Surah An-Nas. In this surah, we first read three verses in which God Almighty says, قُلْ أَعُوذُ بِرَبِّ النَّاسِ مَلِكِ النَّاسِ إِلَهِ النَّاسِ. Say, I take refuge in the Lord of men, the Master of men, or the King of men, and the God of men. So the question we would like to ask today is what the difference is between these three attributes of God, first of all, Malik, Rabb, and Ilah. And secondly, what is the reason why God Almighty has, mentioned these in these three verses, and why God has asked us to in this surah, in this chapter of the Holy Quran, why God has asked us to take refuge in these three sublime and divine attributes. So we can begin our little investigation here by mentioning something regarding Surah An-Nas. Surah An-Nas is the last verse of the Holy Quran, as you're well aware of. And it's one of the smaller surahs. It only has six verses. In this surah, in this chapter, God Almighty orders the Prophet to seek refuge from the whisperings or the temptations of the devil, right? And actually, to be more specific, he asks the Prophet to seek refuge in these three divine attributes, right? So we can say that these three attributes, first of all, in general terms, have been mentioned, because when we can look examine this from a psychological point of view, in the sense that when a human being feels that he's has come face to face with some sort of danger, something threatens him, obviously he wants to take refuge and seeks refuge in a power that can repel them and protect himself from that evil. So, and it's for this reason that in general terms, when we come face to face with, you know, any kind of danger, whether regardless of whether it's spiritual or physical, we are asked by God to seek refuge in him, because he's obviously the ultimate power and nothing can overcome him. This is the reason why, in general terms, we've been asked to seek refuge in God. Now, the question arises as to why is it that we've been asked to seek refuge, not specifically in God, but in the three attributes that God, from the point of view of these three attributes, meaning seek refuge in his lordship, his rububiyat, his malikiyat, or his sovereignty, as well as his uluhiyat, or his divinity. Right. So let's start with his rububiyat, his rububiyat and his lordship over human beings. Obviously, God Almighty is, when we say God Almighty is the Rabb or the Lord of human beings, it means he's the person who sustains them and takes care of them, right? So, and takes care of all their needs. So therefore, obviously he is the person, or he is the being to whom we should seek refuge in when we come face to face with this danger. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We're examining the first three verses of Surah Nas. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
NATO critics say the alliance's expansion is what led to the war in Ukraine, and now moves are afoot to provoke Moscow even further. It looks almost certain that Finland, and most probably Sweden, are to join NATO. Via video link, senior Helsinki officials set out their case to the European Parliament on Thursday as to why Finland would fit right in.
Finland has many high-end capabilities, including a fighter jet fleet of F-80s, gradually to be replaced by recently ordered 64 F-35 jet fighters.
Sweden's Malin Björk asked, what's the rush given that her country and Finland have said they don't feel under immediate threat? However, it seems most EU lawmakers are supportive.
We think that it is not only defining for Finnish security, but it's only an important step in European history.
Finland's border with Russia stretches for 1,300 kilometres. Membership would mean NATO's land border with the Federation would more than double. The Kremlin has warned there will be military retaliation if the plan goes ahead. Experts aren't ruling out the possibility of World War III.
This creates a major problem, because when you change the architecture of security, of course, you create waves of reaction and perceived threats, which is the case for Russia now.
The US and its European allies are spending enormous amounts of money on arming Ukraine. One EU lawmaker criticized this during Thursday's proceedings.
We have a very powerful arms industry in the European Union, and many nations rely on arms exports. We should be doing all we can to prevent conflicts escalating instead.
Analysts say it could take up to a year for Finland to fully join NATO, but in the meantime, it will become a de facto member. The question is, in the event of escalation, will it be viewed as protected or as a target? Jerome Hughes, Brussels. Okay.
Young people are those who most seriously bore the brunt for the COVID crisis in the European Union. A preliminary study carried out by European Cooperation Programme Specialised in Regional Analysis, or ESPON, has found youth unemployment across the EU went up by almost 22% with respect to pre-pandemic levels, with jobs going wasted in sectors affected the most by anti-COVID restrictions, such as hotels, restaurants and retail business.
Things have changed for the worse during the pandemic, definitely. I work as a kitchen hand and I've only been offered casual employment over the past months.
The COVID health crisis has been an eye-opener for many young workers. Suddenly we found ourselves thrown into making a choice between badly paid, casual work and spending time at home doing nothing.
Food supply chain and tourism account together for about 35% of Italy's GDP. During the COVID crisis, hundreds of thousands of small and medium firms were forced to shut down, and a large number of young workers, the vast majority of whom under casual underpaid contracts, were left stranded. The Italian youth unemployment rate has traditionally stood at worrying levels. For almost two decades, youth joblessness in Italy has been more than the double of the total EU average, reaching a whopping 45% in 2015.
Today, young people bear the brunt for 20 years of political choices which have included austerity policies, hence jobs cuts and funding cuts to education services, and labour policies which have deregulated the labour market, introducing tens of casual working contracts which have left the youth unprotected and unwilling to consider job opportunities in Italy.
The ESPON study has also found that over 60% of people aged 18 to 34 were at risk of depression in the EU in 2021, with the deterioration in mental health being particularly evident among those who had lost the occupation. Max Civili, Rome.
The Embassy of Palestine in the Russian Federation organized a ceremony to pay tribute for veteran Al Jazeera journalist Shirin Abu Akleh, who was killed by Israeli forces in Jenin on Wednesday. Her colleagues, fellow journalists and people gathered near the embassy to condemn the Israeli regime for what they called the heinous crime.
Shirin's a person I knew well. She was murdered in cold blood. This is a great loss, not only for Al Jazeera, but for the entire journalistic community. Shirin was very professional, famous, and her name was associated primarily with Palestine. She's long been a symbol for the Palestinian people who are seeking freedom and justice.
Abu Akleh's killing follows a long string of Israeli attacks on Palestinian journalists. According to the database of the Committee to Protect Journalists, 24 journalists have been killed in Israel and the Palestinian territories since 1992. While 14 people were caught in the crossfire, others appear to have been deliberate victims.
At least she made with me at least 5-6 interviews. Usually we saw her everywhere, the checkpoints, Jerusalem, in Gaza, in Jenin, in West Bank, everywhere. Where we need her, we find her, exactly. She's a very active journalist. And we are, as Palestinians, we never make a differentiation between Muslim and the Christian, never.
Journalists who were with Abu Akleh, including one who was shot and wounded, said Israeli forces fired upon them even though they were clearly identifiable as reporters.
The assassination of journalist Shirin Abu Akleh is another crime to be added to the criminal record of the Israeli regime, which for decades has been trying to silence the voice of truth and obliterate the Palestinian cause. Marina Kartonova, Moscow.
Sandwiched between the towering Alborz mountain range and the Caspian Sea, Iran's city of Sari has been a hot tourist target for its spectacular natural sceneries. This has won the city the title of the tourism capital of the ecoregion in 2022. The city has invited the country's officials and foreign ambassadors to celebrate the designation of the title.
There are several criteria. For example, it's of course the historical sites, the beautiful nature, and necessary existing necessary infrastructure for tourism. So All these criteria in general can contribute for the selecting and announcing the particular city or particular place in eco-region as a eco-capital.
Iran is among the top 10 countries in the world when it comes to tourism. We have a wide range of capacities from ecotourism to historical tourism and especially marine tourism. Our country has a 5,400-kilometer long coastline, which potentially makes it a hot destination for sea tourism. Now it's time to use our resources and strengthen the infrastructure, such as accommodation, to boost our tourism industry.
The Economic Cooperation Organization, or shortly ECCO, is an Asian political and economic intergovernmental entity with 10 member states, including Iran, Turkey, and Pakistan. Sari was selected as the tourism capital of ECCO during the third ECCO ministerial meeting on tourism, held in October 2019 in Tajikistan. The Tajik capital, Dushanbe, was earlier named the tourism capital of ECCO for the year 2021. And Iran's northwestern city of Ardabil will succeed Sari as the 2023 capital of the ECCO region. Officials say the initiative opens up new opportunities for investment in the designated city, which will help boost the tourism infrastructure.
I can say that many countries in ECCO region are taking steps towards the facilitation of the issuing visas for the citizens of ECCO member states. And so, of course, the facilitation or removing the visas, it's is important factor in increasing the number of touristic arrivals. Could contribute in the development of touristic sector in ECCO region.
From the Caspian Hyrcanian mixed forests to marshlands, wildlife refuge, and an amazing beach, the mesmerizing and diverse nature of Sari indeed deserves to be titled the tourism capital of ECCO. The organization says it will continue the initiative and will name new cities as tourism capitals each year to boost cooperation between tourism entities of the member states. With its eye-catching landscapes and mesmerizing nature, Sari has already been a tourist magnet for mainly Iranian travelers. And now with its designation as the tourism capital of the ECCO region, the city should expect a larger number of foreign tourists to visit the city and enjoy its attractions. Yusuf Jalali, Sari.
On Wednesday morning, Palestinians woke up to the tragic news of the brutal killing of Al Jazeera journalist Shireen Abu Akleh in the Jenin refugee camp. Abu Akleh was killed after being shot in the head while covering Israeli army raids in the northern occupied West Bank. Her killing drew angry reactions and condemnations in Palestine and around the world. Palestinian resistance groups, including Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, condemned in the strongest terms Israel's killing of the Palestinian journalist.
The Zionist enemy killed Shireen in cold blood in another example of their brutality against Palestinians. Killing her exposes the violent and criminal nature of the Zionist regime. We condemn this brutal crime and we demand that the Zionist regime and its leaders be brought to justice for their crimes.
Shireen Abu Akleh's extrajudicial killing is further evidence of a trend by Israeli regime forces to systematically attack journalists. During the 11-day war in 2021, Israeli warplanes bombed several buildings in Gaza, housing media companies and news channels.
The Zionist regime attacks journalists in order to silence them and to hide the truth. By targeting Palestinian journalists, the Zionist regime wants to terrorize us and stop us from exposing its war crimes to the world. The Zionist regime doesn't want us to show its ugly face.
Statistics show that Israeli regime forces have killed some 50 Palestinian journalists during the last 22 years. During the Great March of Return, Israeli snipers shot and killed two Gazan journalists and injured dozens more.
This is not the first time Israeli armed forces has targeted Palestinian journalists. They have targeted a number of them during the Great March of Return in 2018. And this is also another addition to Israeli illegal practices against Palestinian journalists by killing Shireen Abu Akleh, one of the most famous journalists in the Palestinian territories. Israel is trying to kill the truth.
Experts say Israeli forces will continue with their violations against journalists as long as the international community keeps turning a blind eye. Israeli forces have been increasingly attacking journalists in recent years. Palestinian journalists risk their lives on a daily basis to cover the news and expose the brutality of the Israeli regime. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
With every candle symbolizing the path she lit, activists and journalists gathered in front of the Embassy of Palestine in Tehran, not just to condemn her killing by an Israeli sniper, but to show the world that Shirin Abu Akleh's footsteps will be followed. Al Jazeera's 51-year-old journalist was targeted on assignment while wearing a press jacket that made it easy for her to be identified as a journalist.
The policies of our Zionist enemies has always been clear. They are against anyone who unveils the reality on the ground. The killing of a well-known journalist like Shirin shows that they obviously don't want the world to know the truth about Palestine.
We lost a dear colleague who was killed on assignment. This is a sad day for journalists all over the world. What makes it even more tragic is that she was not even in a war zone. This proves that freedom of speech and human rights means nothing to the Zionist regime.
The Palestinian journalist was also a citizen of the United States, and many are now asking why the U.S. is silent about what they can only describe as blatant murder. Shirin was a veteran journalist and very well known, too. Obviously, the Israeli regime does not want the world to know about its crimes, and that's why they silenced her.
Well, this shows the cruelty of the Israeli regime. As you can see, if we see such an act in other countries, we may face with a strong reaction by the Western governments and also Western media. But today, inside occupied Palestine, we have seen one of the most cruel scenes that could be possible. An Israeli soldier attacked a journalist and killed him in front of the camera. And this shows that, unfortunately, by the double standards of the Western governments and also Western medias, Israeli governments can continue to kill and assassinate everyone. And this is completely against the freedom of speech and the freedom of the Palestinian people.
Shirin Abu Akleh was covering the Israeli forces' raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank on Wednesday. The veteran television correspondent was a household name across the Arab world for her bold coverage of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
The tragic event has sparked outrage in Iran as well as other parts of the world. Those who have gathered in front of the Palestinian embassy in Tehran are calling for impunity for Israel to end. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
Following the killing of Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Akleh, Yemeni journalists have gathered in front of the Palestinian embassy in Sana'a to denounce Israeli crimes against Palestinian journalists and media activists.
The Yemeni Journalists Union condemns what has happened to Shirin Abu Akleh and her colleague. They were directly targeted by Israeli forces while wearing a press vest to ensure protection in the areas of conflict based on international conventions. Her killing is a flagrant violation of international law. We call on all media activists around the world to express solidarity with Abu Akleh and other colleagues in Palestine.
The Yemeni media activists denounced in the strongest terms the targeted killing of Abu Akleh by Israeli forces as she was covering an Israeli raid in the occupied West Bank.
The news of the martyrdom of Shirin was shocking. And the whole world is shocked because she was a powerful and influential figure and was able to represent a strong voice. The killing of Shirin is a turning point and the beginning.